the Business and Building Movement, the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
MS-13, Sucrece, everybody out there that represents something. So put your weapons down and let's come to a table so we could talk peace.
Today on the show, a remarkable man who has saved a country on its way to collapse. A conversation with the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. Let me start by reminding you what happened in Rwanda 15 years ago. Over a period of just 100 days, 800,000 men, women, and children were killed, most of them slaughtered with knives, machetes, and axes by their neighbors. It is perhaps the most brutal genocide in modern history. Many of you probably remember its portrayal in the movie Hotel Rwanda. By the time it ended, one-tenth of the country's population was dead. Most people assumed that Rwanda was broken, and like Somalia, another country wrecked by violence, it would become a poster child for Africa's failed states. 15 years later, Rwanda is a poster child after all, but for entirely different reasons. It is now among the most stable countries in Africa. Average incomes have tripled. Education, healthcare, tourism, and trade are all improving dramatically. The government is widely seen as one of the more efficient and honest ones in Africa. Fortune magazine published an article recently titled Why CEOs Love Rwanda, citing the heads of Google, Costco, and Starbucks as among those who are fans of the country and its president. Kagame says his goal is to have his country stop receiving foreign aid altogether. But before he could achieve some economic success, Kagame had to achieve social stability. And he had to do it in extraordinary circumstances. As the New Yorker writer Philip Gurevich points out, Rwanda is unique in post-conflict countries. In Germany, the victims, the Jews, left for America and Israel. In the Balkans, the warring groups split up geographically. In Cambodia, the class that perpetrated the violence was easily identifiable, and those people could be separated. In Rwanda, however, the killers and the victims live now side by side in every village, in every community. Imagine Nazis and Jews living next door to one another throughout the country. The only way to make peace in Rwanda was to reintegrate these communities. And Kagame came up with a specially crafted solution using a kind of local courts called gachachas. In each village, the killers stood before their neighbors and confessed, and in turn were often offered forgiveness. Part court, part community council, part group therapy. It made for a fascinating historical experiment that seems to be working. We will talk with Paul Kagame about how he did this and about some of the controversy that surrounds his presidency. And now I welcome Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Mr. President, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Many people look at what's happening in Rwanda as a miracle. 15 years ago, you had this extraordinary, horrific genocide, and now Rwanda is one of the most stable countries in Africa. But what I'm most struck by is that you have done this with a very strange kind of process. Why was it important not to punish the killers?
We realize, first of all, there are many killers. As I said, there are hundreds of thousands. Because the genocide that took place in our country involved a huge percentage of our population, both in terms of those who were killed and those who killed them. And if you went technically to try each one of them, as the law may suggest, then you would lose out on rebuilding a nation, on bringing people back together. That's why we had to say, let's categorize responsibilities. Let's really look at the masterminds of this genocide. People who are behind it, who are the architects, the leaders. I think these bear the biggest responsibility in this. So those ones, we had to take them to the ordinary courts of law. But there were there was this big number of people in rural areas who killed. People really thought justice had to be done and had to be seen done in a sense of saying, if you got involved in any way in contributing to loss of life or directly or indirectly, you need to be tried, you need to be sent to jail, you need to, you know, and that's how it started. We had about 130,000 people in jail. And there were many more outside that you couldn't find jail for who had this responsibility as well.
So then you started thinking.
Then we started thinking. You said, no, but we must get out of this problem. We can't get stuck with this problem. We have to move on. We have to build our future. We can't just get stuck with the problems created by our past and by our history and different responsibilities. We have to find a formula to get out of this. But at the same time, create an opening for people to live a new life, so to speak, giving them a chance to understand that this was wrong and that there is a future for them and for the country in which they should participate. That's how really we modeled it.
But now you are a leader who happens to be Tutsi. The Tutsis were the victims of the genocide. Did you not have important segments of your community saying to you, how can you do this? How can you let these people pay no price?
Absolutely. That's a point. That's a good point. I mean, it happened. People who have been victims, there are others who are perpetrators, and you want, in the process of justice, to bring them back together, to live together and accept one another and value one another. So, so to speak, there is a conflict here you have to manage that is so complex. The only way we could get out of that was such a process like the Kachacha process, which, and really people would come out, some of the perpetrators would come out and show remorse and apologize and confess and even give information that people didn't have in understanding really what happened and who was involved and to what extent. So, and then on that basis, people would forgive. Even people sitting there in the courts, after hearing that, after hearing the testimonies given by different people.
But is this process still very fragile? Because, you know, these people, the killers, are now back in these villages, living amongst the people they killed. Mm. And there's, you know, a very favorable biography of yours. Even there, Stephen Kinzer's book, he says, you get the feeling these people are mouthing platitudes about reconciliation, but they don't really believe it. There's another writer, Philip Gurevich, writes about asking this guy who killed six people, I think he said, did you enjoy it? He said, yes, I enjoyed killing these people. And he's back living with those people. Is this being held together by very fragile bonds?
I think there are many more cases of people who regret what they did. So these ones must also be heard. And in fact, they contribute a lot also to this future I'm talking about. So there are many more cases of people who come forward and repent and show remorse. And it's like even psychologically they have been affected. They are really at a loss as to how to lead their lives. So we're also trying to manage that kind of situation. And there are probably more people in that category than even in those who find nothing wrong in what they did. So there is a lot of, there is a balancing act to do here. But we are still better off with this situation than either doing nothing or pursuing other alternatives.
But when you look at what a lot of other countries do, I mean, in Iraq, for example, you know, one community came to power, felt that it had been persecuted by the other, a lot of vengeance, de-bathification. You look at the Balkans, great, you know, much retribution. Do you feel like those are not the paths that will work?
I think maybe the facts on the ground will speak for themselves. But in most cases, if you pursue things like that, you don't end up with good results. At least that is the lesson we've learned from our own situation. I don't know whether it works for other situations, but I can speak for my own situation. It has worked. It has worked better than anything I could have thought of. Or even today, we don't see people giving us the alternative. We have had people criticize all of this that has made sense for us and given us good results, but we haven't heard from them alternatives that we should have pursued.
And we'll be back with the president of Rwanda.
Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, July 22nd, 2009. Now, I would normally let the president of any recognized independent sovereign nation continue to speak. However, when you have a queen of the planet Earth with exquisite knowledge on Africa and something to offer, you don't delay. No, you do not keep a black woman waiting. Ma'am, are you on the line? Just
yes.
Okay,
yes,
that's
I
it.
Am.
That's it. Hold on. Yeah, you know, you just interrupted the president of an independent sovereign nation.
Oh, I did.
Yes.
Oh, I did. And who was that?
Mr. Paul Kagame of Rwanda.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. That's right. I don't know how you feel about him. Maybe that was good.
No, I think he's quite a character. He's a unique person.
Well, for those that don't know, if you were logged into blackelectorate.com on Friday, we had the honor of posting a very informative piece on doing business in Africa. And that piece is still available, maybe about 20 pieces down. But I had the honor of meeting someone very, I would say one of the highlights of my Africa or post-Africa experience. You know, sometimes you do some things and it catches the attention of people that you probably would not have met any other way. Well, when the African Union named me as one of the members of the First Congress of African Economists, somebody reached out to me very quickly. And that person's on the line now. Lori Elliott, a vision strategist, facilitator focused on large-scale systematic interventions in business, technology, economic development, youth development, and my beautiful favorite word, community development, praise God, and entrepreneurship. Just a wonderful person. We've become fast friends over the last, I think, what, 3 months, Lori?
Yeah, it's been, actually, it might be going on 4 months
okay,
now.
A four-month anniversary.
Yes.
And she wrote the piece, Doing Business in Africa, What We Can Learn from Obama's Ghana Speech. How are you, Lori?
I'm doing great.
Did you love how I just talk all over you and then just let you introduce yourself about 3 minutes
exactly.
later?
Exactly.
Well, listen, the way we met is really part of the story. I see you as one of the great emerging leaders in our generation. And when I say emerging, it's not that you haven't been on the front line, so to speak, doing what you do. But there are others, when you bring up Africa issues, there's a kind of like an establishment group of individuals who, mm-hmm. you know, who get the limelight first, and they well deserve. You know, they've worked very hard to do what they do. But just tell me a little bit and tell us a little bit about you, what your focus has been.
Okay.
And then we'll get into some of the more topical stuff.
Okay. Well, I think one of the key things is that I don't necessarily consider myself an emerging leader, but I do agree that we are shifting paradigms in what we're going to see happening in Africa.
Please elaborate.
From an old system to a new system. And we are going to see emerging leaders. And we're actually, it's interesting because Monday, it was actually, it's a 40-year generation, which is shifting of generations. You know, the walk on the moon in 1969, that was 40 years ago. Woodstock, and I'm talking to Americans when I speak of this. And so, and even in around that time when we look in Africa, we look at that the last 40 years have been dominated by strongmen. Omar Bongo of Gabon just died. He was one of the strongmen. Even Gaddafi, that is promoting the African Union and doing a lot of things towards that now, he actually came into his position 40 years ago, September. So what we're seeing is a lot of what we're seeing in Africa is actually shifting paradigms, a new generation that's arising, new leaders bringing new visions. And so I think that's part of the work that I'm doing. On a more practical level, I work with youth entrepreneurs and look at ways of creating for-profit enterprises that actually promote economic development in a broad sense.
And Lori, before yeah. Could you give us some of the websites that?
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. Just to start out, the concept of the broad-based economic development, that's at www.shuja.info, and I'll spell that, it's shuja.info. And what's interesting is for those of you who are African or understand Swahili, Shuja stands for champion, means champion in Swahili. And the idea behind that came from the concept of Ubuntu in a lot of ways. Desmond Tutu has said that if any of us, if the world is going to prosper, we have to learn that all of us have to prosper. I'm not saying it precisely. And obviously that's the African concept of Ubuntu. We cannot do or exist without one another. And so that's where we came up with that concept. And then for those of you who are interested in doing business in Africa, we have another website called Afribiz, A-F-R-I-B-I-Z .info. And that gives you really a collection of the information that's available everywhere around the internet on the economics and business climates in Africa. Now, what's interesting is one of the things that I often hear from people is that, oh, I can't get any information about doing it in Africa. I've been doing research, I think, for the last 2 or 3 years, and most of these resources are available. They're free, and it's information overload, so there's plenty of information. It's just that people don't really know how to get to it.
Wonderful.
So those would be the two that I would, you know, highlight. And then generally from there, you can contact me on any of the websites if
okay.
you want additional information.
Now, great. Now, I wanted to talk to you a handful of topics,
mm-hmm.
But I think your piece on President Obama's trip to Ghana is a segue into the larger issue of some of the global trends and issues where Africa's evolved or involved
exactly.
economically. What are some of your thoughts on global trends and issues and President Obama's speech in Ghana, which got mixed reviews?
Yes, and I think it's, again, we're talking about paradigm shifts. I think from the standpoint, I'll just highlight the key points that I made, and then I'll segue into how this is indicative of the shifts that we're seeing globally. First of all, I talked about that you need to have purpose when you're doing anything with Africa, and that's the case. You know, as we as business people, we know that if you're in business, you're not just there trying to make money. Now, money obviously is important, and profit is important, but the existence of your company, its ability to compete, is based on its purpose. So oftentimes people have taken a lackadaisical attitude towards Africa. Oh, we might do business, we might do this, we might do that. But they really hadn't formulated a purpose for being there. So I think that's the first thing. Second thing is that if you listen to President Obama's speech, he was really talking about that, you know, this new era, what he wanted was partnerships instead of patronage. And I think, you know, some will say that's great. Others will say, well, you know, how can Africa be a partner? And I just from a historical standpoint, I'm not necessarily an African historian, but from a global perspective, what's happened is that the colonial system that existed and even the capitalist system that has existed that's been operating in Africa for the last 50 or so years has still been very much on the concept that the West, America, you know, we're the big brother or the father or the mother, and we need to take care of Africa. And whether it's economics, whether it's social, we can see that in many of our aid programs, our donor programs, where we've created cycles. And the aid, we're continually doing aid. I'll just give you an example. I have a friend. She worked for a group a donor group that was funded by the United States. And I think they got billions of dollars to provide food for the refugees in Sudan. Okay? When she was working on the project, she said, well, you know, why don't we invest some of this money in showing them how to develop their own economic enterprises so they'll be self-sustaining? she was told, if you do that, we're out of business. Okay? So we've created a system that has created dependency. And when we talk about partnership, what we're recognizing in terms of a paradigm shift is that we no longer see sovereign states, whether Africa or elsewhere, that are dependent on us or independent of us, but interdependent. Okay, and that's what partnership is. You recognize your own strengths, you work in your own strengths, but then you find partners that you can work with that can take you to the next level. Okay, and I think that's a new message in many ways for both Americans and for Africans alike. Where America, we can no longer say, for example, that, you know, we're totally independent of any other country in this world. Nothing that happens elsewhere affects us, okay? But at the same time, the countries that we work with, whether they're small or large, we can no longer take the responsibility to make them dependent for whatever our objectives are. And I think the global crisis has really shown us that because, you know, here we still have promises that countries have made to Africa for aid, correct?
Unfunded.
And they weren't fulfilling them before, right? Okay. Now, during a crisis where they need to put resources into their own sovereign countries, you know, Africa's still saying, or the international saying, you need to meet your commitments to Africa, okay? And I think what's happened is we're now starting to see, I think even just a natural tiredness of that process, you know? I mean, you know, when a crisis hits, it often causes institutions to shake. Things that don't work, they go away. And I think that's what we're starting to see with the crisis. Another thing is that, and this is somewhat tied to being a partner, but also that Africa is a serious player in the global economy. It's not just a bystander. What happens in Africa is significant, what they do and develop. From an economic standpoint, we can look at, and this has always been the case, but it's been overshadowed by the economic systems that were in place, colonialism, capitalism, as we've seen it in the last 40, 50 years. We keep seeing everyone, you know, in the media, we keep seeing the conflicts, we keep seeing the issues, and they're real and they're tangible. But that's not the only picture of Africa. You know, when we think of the resources, the raw resources, gold, minerals, water, all of the things that seem to help China and the others run their industrial countries, including the West, Africa has it. So why is it that Africa is considered to be insignificant in the global economy? We see a lot of China now. I keep reading these reports in the last 2 weeks. China continues to invest in private companies. The state of China continues to invest in their private sectors to do business in Africa. And I don't necessarily have a problem with China, but what I'm saying is if Africa was so insignificant, then why is China spending a lot of money there? Okay, so.
Well, let me ask you a few questions, and everyone, we're listening to Lori Elliott. If you want to learn more, several websites that you can go to. We'll give those out momentarily. But just to jump in where you are, what you're saying, there's been a relationship that many people are familiar with that primarily involved the West, Europe, the United States, and now you've seen the emergence of China and India, and you're right. These countries are open, they're more honest, I think, and probably a little more, the rhetoric is a lot more respectable in their view of Africa. But is it a different relationship fundamentally, or are China and India and Japan and some of the other nations that are now getting involved in Africa just a better version of what we already saw?
I think that's an interesting one, and I think we would have to really study the histories of the countries because a lot of the relationships and how they relate to others is based on historical, you know, their history, their culture. I think that I don't want to give any real opinions, okay? I'll put it this way.
Well, Lauren, let me say this is why I'm asking the question.
That's why you're asking. Okay.
No, the reason why I'm asking the question is because I think you've hit the nail on the head that Africa now is a more it's popular to bring it up. It's accepted now to bring it up. the reasons behind that now point to, I think, what you're suggesting, which is these nations, whether they'll admit it or not, they actually need Africa. It's not that they want to do business there. They actually have to.
to further their precious mineral
interests, et cetera, military, all of that.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
Maybe flip it. Let's flip it from the African perspective. Maybe that would be a better way, from the ground up. How does this all look from the African perspective, economically and from the grassroots level, these evolving relationships with geopolitical partners?
Okay. And I think that's the comment I was going to make in terms of an opinion about this. What I was talking about, I mentioned the colonial and then we had the capitalist system that overrided, that really dominated Africa in the last, you know, couple hundred years, okay? And what we're seeing now is we're seeing emerging economic systems. And I'm calling one China because it is both a sovereign issue, but also it's a way that they've combined their economic and social fabric and how they do business, okay? It's not capitalism, it's not communism, okay? So they have a particular system. And then, of course, you can look at India. But one of the other things that I wanted to mention is that what's always been there in Africa and which has been overshadowed by all of these other systems is what I call the community system. That's what you're talking about, the grassroots, the bottom up. And what's happened with the shake in the global economy and also with technology, we're now actually seeing a rise in those community systems. They may be smaller in a sense, but if we look at the world according to what we're learning now in network science about how everything is connected, okay, we're actually seeing that there's systems and patterns evolving. And what we're seeing is that there are alternative pathways to accomplish the same thing. And let me just give you an example. For example, I was doing an interview with a lady, and she's really big on her name is Verna Ali, and she actually focuses on value networks, which is tapping into the hidden assets, your people relationships and your social relationships in terms of business. And one of the things that she pointed out is that, you know, they did a study with a group in terms of the global financial systems. And what they found is that there's a, you know, strong formal system that we're used to, what we see. But there are actually alternative financial systems that are existing and are growing, like in microfinance and others.
Right.
So what we're seeing is that there's actually, what we're going to see probably in the next 20 years with this generation, is that the community systems that we're talking about are actually going to be the predominant system. It's not that you're not going to see China. It's not that you're not going to see capitalism. But you're going to see that those small systems are going to somehow interconnect to a larger system.
Okay, so this is what you actually are painting out in terms of a new worldview. Is that
exactly? Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
This is interesting. You're suggesting that it may not matter as much what Africa's relationship is with the geopolitical partners or players externally. It's more so what's happening internally, parallel to that.
Right, and then they're understanding their unique value, so that they can partner correctly with those other systems, okay?
Gotcha.
Because the issue is that you don't, the other systems have, again, been mechanisms for control and dependency over Africa. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that's what you don't want. So what's happening is you're seeing that rise. Now, even, let me just give you one example in China as an alternative system. Now, what they said is that China has pushed money into, the state has pushed money into banks so that they could give loans to, business people, right, during the economic crisis. But what they found was is that it didn't benefit the small business people. It was the established large firms.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is how the small business people are getting by is that they're doing the traditional community things. People are pooling money or loaning each other money, okay, in order to keep the business growing or to do whatever they need to do, okay? And that's what I keep talking about, that community system. So while all this stuff is going on, you know, we see all of this stuff about the formal system that we that seems to be operating the world, there's actually these other systems that are working and functioning very well, in fact, during this time.
Very good point. Now,
exactly.
From the perspective of the African diaspora, those of us in the United States, you got listeners right now in Toronto, Central South America, all over, really. What are the opportunities for us? What's the game looking like for us? We're not China, we're not India, we're not, Europe, exactly. And we're not the United States. We're just mm-hmm. people, sons and daughters of Africa.
Exactly.
Where do we fit?
And I think, again, it goes back to looking at how to do business, and this will be a predominant system. We're not talking about something that's going to be sidelined anymore, okay? So I think the first thing is have a mental shift, okay? Realizing that this will be a typical way of doing business. It's based on relationships, social structures, and Africa is going to be a shining example of how to do that, okay? So when we're talking about that, you can do it from different, you know, perspectives. Some of you may choose in the African diaspora. Some of you may choose to go back home, okay? There is actually recognition for that. In fact, until the end of July 31st, I will give this website. It's called the African Diaspora Marketplace. The USAID and a couple of other organizations are doing matching grants for people, Africans, who are in the diaspora who want to go back to Africa to actually do business. They're focusing now not so much just on aid, but on economic growth. So what we're going to see is we're going to see those informal channels. I'll give just a simple example. McClatchy, it's a newspaper group, right? Okay, they have a reporter who covers Sub-Sahara Africa. He did a report, he was in the Congo, and he was, you know, did an open piece or opinion piece or feature piece. And he just commented how he was taking a taxi from one part of Lubumbashi to the other. And his taxi driver stopped off to pick up a mineral like copper from a local artisanal miner. And he transported it to the local processing center. So what we see is we see all these informal business networks that are there that are working. And I think the opportunity for the diaspora is to say, you know, many of you still have strong connections back home. How can we tap into those in order to strengthen the local economies but also make money so you can invest? For example, what I would say is one example I've given to you, Cedric, is that gold is one of the biggest best investments now and forever, right? Okay? You don't just have to invest on the market.
Mm-hmm.
Local natives often have, or indigenous groups, they actually have rights, concession mineral rights, to land with gold, silver, whatever, in African countries. But they don't know how to bring it to market. Okay? You can actually work with a local community who has those rights to develop methods for them extracting gold, for example, and then bringing it to market, okay? You can do things, for example, water, okay? There are small businesses in telecommunications, almost anything in Africa. The key is building those, the key to this whole thing is building those relationships. There's opportunities in telecommunications, there's opportunities in water, in energy.
Now, Lori, if let me mic it down a little bit.
Yeah.
And everyone, we're listening to Lori Lee Elliott, and she gave me permission with the Lee in quotes.
Yes.
Lori
yeah.
Lee Elliott.
Yeah.
Afribiz, let me give the sites, www.afribiz.info. That's AFRIBIZ.info. Also, www.lori-elliott.com. And the other one, Shuja, I don't know how my Swahili is, please.
It's www.shuja.info.
Okay, now, when I was in Kenya, we talked about some of these issues, and since I've been back nonstop,
mm-hmm.
even what you just referred to there, there's always been this relationship between the trader and the subsistence farmer and the rest of the populace,
mm-hmm.
small entrepreneur. There's been mm-hmm. some benefits that have come from that, of course, and of course there's been exploitation.
Right.
So when you bring up any relationship between someone outside of Africa, even if they're from the diaspora, and a local population, we know that other communities have had similar arrangements where a local community had concessions on mining, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make sure that our involvement or our engagement is an improvement and doesn't repeat an exploitative past? Is that based upon a mutual education that goes on between the local community and ourselves, or is that based upon us having a new worldview in terms of what a profit may be, what kind of revenue we expect?
I think it's probably both. Remember that typically we've been modeling what success seems to be in the world, right? So with the old system, it was, you know, you need to control everything, right? Okay? And so when people came in, they were investors, oftentimes it was very overriding. It was still a patronage type of system at best, okay? Here what we're saying is that we have to recognize that the sovereignty of an individual, of a community, of a nation. If there's an African community that has those resources, you treat them as equal partners, okay? Now, in that, from the community side, they have to see themselves as equal partners as well, not people who are given money to, but are part of the process, okay? So that's the first thing. Then the education is, it comes a lot with governance and transparency. When you're in that relationship as key partners, you're not trying to accomplish all these other ulterior motives, okay? Not that you won't have any, but the core is that you have come together for a common purpose in business so that everyone profits. For example, if in these relationships, doesn't matter what type of business, when we talk about like the governments being involved, you know, everyone's worried about bribery under the table. Well, I'm saying just make it transparent. Give the government, if they're giving a concession for mining, give them 10% of the ownership, right? They will get revenue from that, whether that's considered tax or not, right? Then you have the community that will own a good percentage. And then the investors and or the technical people, whoever's involved, everybody gets a piece, you know? But, for example, the investors, instead of owning maybe, I don't know, 75%, they would end up at some point, depending on the type of business, they would maybe own 40, you know, to 50, maybe even less. And the key is, again, it is really a mental shift first. The key is that you're creating an environment where everybody can profit from it, okay? That concept of everybody prospers, the community. And we really have to have that mindset in order to make those changes in the new economy. And what's going to be interesting is people are going to find that the old way of doing things will not work on the whole.
Right, just in general. There's a new atmosphere.
Right. So we really are in a shift.
Okay.
And you can, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to ask you, as this relates geopolitically, the hot topic of the month, and I have to say it, I like what is it Dambisa Moyo is saying?
Yes.
But there is a tendency to allow Africa to only have one flavor issue of the month. So now the new thing, the end thing, the chic issue, the cause celebrate for Africa is no more foreign aid, ending aid dependency.
Yeah.
I like a lot of what she says, but what's your take on her book and this argument about ending aid dependency in Africa?
Can I tell you, I agree with her 100%. Not because I don't think aid is useful and it has its place. But it's out of place now. Again, and even President Obama, in his speech, he mentioned it, you cannot have a system of aid. The point of aid is to help people so that they are self-sustaining. When you create those dependencies, it's defeating, okay? And I think what we're doing, but we're seeing a shift. For example, the G8 summit, instead of doing food aid, for example, they are now doing food investment in agriculture. So they're looking at self-sustaining models instead of models that just create more aid. Okay, so I agree with her on the whole. I may not agree with her approach, but I am very strong that aid as we've been doing it does not make the difference. We've created dependencies, and it's literally from the U.S., from whatever country, from Africa, it's literally draining the life out of the countries.
Very good. I mean, on balance, I support her and lift her up. Maybe we'll do an interview with her. But the question I have, and I just want to ask your thoughts on this. I don't believe any single sovereign country, whether it's in Africa, with the exception maybe of China, you know, India, can go it alone. So the idea of ending aid dependency, you and I are with that 1,000%. What I haven't seen is what single nation in Africa could actually do that and bring in enough revenue to make up the shortfall. So the solution to me is ideas like hers, ending aid dependency, but also regional integration and continental convergence. That's why I've been so big on the United States of Africa, whether, you know, there's been some kinks in how it's been put together, et cetera. But I just don't believe that you can do what she's saying unless you have a West Africa, North, East, Central, and whichever one I forgot to say, South, that are becoming one market. I don't think you have the scale to withstand certain kinds of external influence. What do you think?
Right. Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. I don't necessarily think the configuration will be, in the future, will be what we think it will be, but the concept of the integration will be there. And I still think they'll be able to recognize the sovereign states in the mix. But one of the things I wanted to say was that what's good about the economic crisis, and everyone I know, it's a lot of pain, but it's forcing Africa to look to itself. And if you look, the concept, they've been talking about integration for a while, right? Okay?
Absolutely.
But the crisis has created an opportunity for them to push for that. And even for the other countries outside, the foreign assistance outside of the continent, to also push for it as well.
Right, absolutely.
So so I think what's happened is, it's always, what, it's been going on for about 50 years, the talk, the formation.
Absolutely.
But I think the crisis is really creating that catalyst that says, you know, we have no choice, we have to do it.
Well, hell, it's nothing like the money running out, Lori, to get
exactly, exactly. And I think that's what, you know, she was talking about in terms of the aid. You know, as long as it's there, it doesn't dry up, we'll never change.
Right,
and I think that's the point that I truly agree with her, you know.
Sure, I do too. I do too. I just think that there's certain arguments that you can craft that the West will love, and they will never encourage you or give you room to raise the other part of the solution, which is proactive. And I think that's regional and continental convergence. So we, you know, you're obviously on that. I'm on that. In conclusion, what is the 101 on how we can kind of improve the direct relationship? You mentioned a U.S. I think AID program, and there's some other diaspora oriented programs with the help of not just, as you know, Lori, not just federal government. There's a lot of city to city. There's a few cities in the United States that actually have sister city relationships with African cities, and I love to see that. So you can get around the federal government and even the state.
What can we
do to make a direct one-to-one without any type of government intermediary, federal, state, or national? What are some of the things we can do?
Well, I think what people need to realize is that, you know, if you're the African diaspora, literally from Africa, if you're African-American, for example, or American, connecting with those groups, because they still have contacts back home. Okay, that's the easiest way. And the thing is, what we talk about is trust relationships, getting really involved with the people here so that you understand how they work and do business, and you develop trust relationships with them. You don't have to always be so concerned about all of the you know, how business gets done in Africa down the line, because the partners that you develop, that you get close to here, for example, they understand how you operate, and you can say, now listen, these are the things that I value. For example, if we're going to do business in Africa, I don't want to exploit the local population. Then you trust them to carry that value that you've worked with on this side to their connections on the other side. And that's one of the things we're promoting, that this is really, because of the internet, because of the globalization, we're going to actually be able to do a lot at the very grassroots level to accomplish the same things that they're trying to accomplish from the top down.
Oh, Lori, you blew it. That was your perfect chance to say, listen to this show. please, one more time, give us all of the websites and maybe even direct email contact with you.
Yes. The websites. First one is afribiz.info. Second one is shuja.info. And I'll just give you my email address from that. You can contact me at info@Lori, L-A-U-R-I, hyphen Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T-T.com.
Now, earlier, Lori gently rejected my title of emerging leader. We will refer to her as vision strategist and facilitator.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that I met you. I'm so excited about the opportunity to work with you, to learn from you, and to bring BlackElectorate.com's viewers and the listeners to this show in a real working relationship, something that you and I have learned about each other rather quickly, as we do not like talk.
We like to do.
That's right. We like to do. So it's an honor to find ways that we can work together. So don't be a stranger. Wish you nothing but success. And you're welcome anytime, of course, to come on this program.
Great.
Okay,
thanks,
Laura.
Thanks, Patrick. And actually, I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Any last words? You want to take a shot at anybody?
No, I just, not really a shot to anybody, but I just really wanted to encourage the African diaspora really to rethink and to find that unique value for yourself, for Africa, and succeed. Leapfrog. Africa's not poor.
That's right.
It's not poor. Okay.
Okay,
great.
Lori, you take care. We'll talk to you soon, all right?
Yes. Bye.
Lori Elliott, y'all. www.afribiz.info. That's AFRIBIZ.info. www.shuja.info. That's www.shuja.info. You'll hear more and more from Lori. If you want to read her latest, she wrote a piece on President Obama's speech in Ghana. It's in the Econ Wall Street section, Doing Business in Africa, What We Can Learn from Obama's Ghana Speech. Email her if you agree, disagree. What I love about Lori is it's not intellectual theory. She's ready to connect us with opportunities on the ground. People that don't agree on Africa, different issues, there's no excuse for us to not work together on the idea of a united Africa or true economic development. We can have political and cultural arguments on the side as we find ways to develop mutually beneficial and mutually respectful relationships that are in the best interest of all of us who care about Africa and who care about business and entrepreneurship. That's a hump that we have got to get over. This idea that we are going to, you know, through political rhetoric and through wearing dashikis, lift up Africa and ourselves. Not going to happen. Send in any comments. Let me read a comment before we head into hour number three, or hour number four. Yeah, I always lose count. This happens every week. Hour number four, headed into. Got a comment. Let me read this. Oh, we got somebody a little upset. Kambale. Kambale from Greensboro, North Carolina says, as I am listening to the show, I am so outraged on how no one is explaining how Rwanda has become a marvel of the world by the killings of 6 million Congolese people to get access to Congo's wealth. Mr. Zakaria, Fareed Zakaria of GPS, could have been far more critical in the interview. The interview was more public relations than anything else. Compare Mr. Zakaria's interview with the BBC's examination of Kagame. Even with Zakaria's softball questions, Kagame had a hard time explaining how he got 95% of the votes in the last Rwandan elections. And then they give me some links on CNN and BBC. Gerard Prunier's Africa's World War. That book speaks on how Rwanda has literally exploited the resources of the Congo. And then they give me another link here. It is a disgrace to a radio show to speak about economic development and using Rwanda as an example when Rwanda's development is happening because of the deaths of 6 million black folks in the continent. And this has been documented by the UN and many human rights organizations. Why is your show silent on the deaths in the Congo, yet speak about Rwanda's economic development based on ill-gotten gains and mass murders? Now, I want to thank this individual named Kambale, but we have to do a little Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program 101. I get the impression that you are from Africa. Now, I may have to take this into hour number four. But we got work to do. There's an assumption, sometimes on the part of Africans toward African Americans or Black Americans, that somehow we are too ignorant or too stupid to have presented a more in-depth view of an issue. I think this person made great points. In fact, let me give a standing ovation. And I'm very happy to have Kambale as a listener. But Kambale, don't insult us. If this is your first time listening, say so. We have dealt at length with the issue of the Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, and all of that in the past. We played Fareed Zakaria's show, which provoked and elicited a response from you. That's how it works here. I've heard people defend Kagame, and I've heard people criticize Kagame. We just allowed you to do so, and I'm grateful for your input. But please, don't be so arrogant to insult the diaspora, to think that we are learning only about Africa from that hot show GPS. Sometimes we agree with Fareed Zakaria, other times we don't. I welcome you and encourage you to continue to listen to this program. Now, here's my question for Kambale from Greensboro, North Carolina, who I'm grateful. Kambale, what can we do in the diaspora, since you have good information on Rwanda? What can we do to help with true economic development in Rwanda? That's my question to you. The floor is yours. I hope you can answer it. I think you make some great points criticizing Kagame. But now I want you to guide us into a better relationship, diaspora to Africa, leading to real economic development in Rwanda or Congo. You tell us what to do. Lori Elliott just gave some great insight. That's my challenge. See, with my program, it's not just about winning an argument. It's about business and building. What can we do to change the stories that we're reading about, listening to, and reporting on? Kambale, the floor is yours. Kambale from Greensboro, North Carolina, I thank you again. Now, what do we do? Practical steps. 101, diaspora to Africa relations. What can we do to improve upon the mistakes that Kagame made? All right. Hour number four. As the great Moses Malone once said, fo, fo, fo. Send in more comments.
Cedric Muhammad, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Only on the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Cedric Muhammad. Muhammad.
No way you'll never make it. Come with the weak shit, I break it. Step into my zone, mad rhymes will stifle ya. Lines like rifles go blast when I kick some. A lot of rappers be like one time wonders. Couldn't say a fly bomb if there was one right under their noses. I hate those motherfucking posers, but I'm so real to them it's scary. But with my unique skills, nah, you can't compare me. And no, we don't make whack tracks. And all the suckers get pushed back when I'm kicking real facts. I represent setups like a tech boy. You're paranoid cause you're a son like Elroy. And you'd be happy to get a record deal. Maybe your soul you'd sell to have massive deal.
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
Oh yes, I'm greater than all MCs. When I breathe, give me room, please. I be like fascinating when I be updating. Cutting off white kids, pulling their trump cards. I thump hard and make them say that I'm God.
Cedric Muhammad.
They're hardcore. Never know the meaning of.
but I get drops like a slogan, and no man could ever try to diss when I kicks my jab. Lyrically deaf and connect and complete mic record. No double checking, vocals kill like weapons. But if I have to, I go all out with no mic. Yeah, that's right, cause I survive mad fights. And for my peeps, I truly care, cause without some of them, I wouldn't be here. And they all know how I feel, cause sucks be like playing themselves to have mass appeal.
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
I know I'm dope, but don't wet that. I've suffered setbacks, but now I'm making greenbacks. Just like back and slack some crazy hip-hop. Check 1, 2, and you don't stop. Your head'll bop when I drop my crop of pure bomb. Just like the seashore, I'm calm and wild with my monotone style.
Because Cedric I don't Muhammad.
Give me a fly beat and I'm all in it. Word is born, I go on and on. For you it's tragic, I got magic like wands. So I'ma end this lecture and I bet ya, those who kick dirt in due time, I'm gonna get ya. Cause I be kicking the rear while they be losing the race trying to chase mass appeal.
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
That's Guru.
Cedric Muhammad.
With his monotone style. Okay, I'm still waiting to hear from, Kambale from Greensboro. Nimba from Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire. He says, I need the email address of this beautiful sister, African sister that you just had on. I think I'm going to have to bring Nimba on the show. He has a clothing line. He tried to get me in that African male pageant, but after I saw some of those photos, Nimba, I had to fall back. A couple of those shots were troubling. Let me give Lori Elliott's information out one more time. Lori Lee Elliott. Email info@lori-elliott.com. Info at Lori, LAUR-ELLIOTT.com. You can go to her websites, www.afribiz.info, afribiz.info. Also Shuja, www.shujaa.info. Nimba has sent in, Nimba from the Ivory Coast has sent in like 5 posts. It is an absolute joy to be able to connect all of us with a meaningful relationship and dialogue, hopefully, over Africa. It kind of gets a little stale to repeat the arguments of who is right or wrong. I want to know how we can get busy on the ground with the people. I want to know, that's why I linked up with Lori. I don't want to just talk to Africanists, folks that want to point me in the direction of the right dashiki, but people who can actually point me in the direction of the white dashiki, and then take me to a tribal community where I can link up and do something. I had Amos Oriku, my 21-year-old friend from Nairobi, Kenya, break down to me. Explained to me what tribe he was in, broke down the whole, gave me a whole analysis of the election in Kenya, what the problems were along tribal lines. I've asked him and another friend of mine in Nairobi to break down the conflict in the Mau Forest. They both are doing so we can have an intelligent conversation from people on the ground who know what's going on, not just Western media. I have a friend who as one parent from Tanzania, another parent from Kenya. It's a beautiful thing to get past intermediaries, to get to know one another and do business. For far too long, we've had third parties representing us one to another.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.